Tell me your secret.
So my secret is that for the last few years, I've spent almost every night sleeping with a stuffed toy wolf. A few years ago, I was going through a bit of a tough time, and a friend of mine said I would be fine because I had the strength of a wolf. And so I bought a stuffed toy. And ever since then, he has slept with me, comforted me. And usually he's a wee spoon when we sleep, but sometimes I let him be big spoon and I don't hate him.
I wanted to tell people, you know, I didn't want to be alone. I felt very isolated and very lonely.
Today, a story that finds its roots in fable.
I just felt overwhelmed by emotion at that point.
When my guest did something that had dire consequences.
It was very reckless of me to do what I did.
He experienced something that humanity has struggled to comprehend through the ages.
What did you see? I didn't see anything.
You have no recollection.
No, I don't.
But outside of our forum, he can never discuss it.
How many people know your secret?
Two.
And why do you keep it a secret?
Out of shame, pure shame. I don't think my loved ones would know how to handle it if they heard the truth. And honestly, I don't know how I'd look at them again.
His story is one of relationship.
It led me to a woman who ultimately became kind of the center point of my secret.
And what was it about her profile that attracted you?
She was hot.
It's also a story of an experience.
And I was trying to explain to her, like, how I just wasn't feeling like meeting up that night. I just wanted to go home. And she was like, I think I can help you.
And his son.
I had a 5-year-old son at the time who loves to jump into my arms. Something happened that just absolutely changed how I felt about my situation and what had happened to me.
Today, The Secret Room presents 2 Minutes.
My name is Joe, and my secret is I was dead for over 2 minutes, and I can't tell anyone.
I'm Ben Hamm.
Okay, perfect.
Okay, good. So I think we are ready to go then.
Yeah, okay? Cool.
Okay. All right, here we go. Hi, Joe. Welcome to The Secret Room.
Hey, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Well, you're welcome. It's really great to have you here. Appreciate your reaching out with your deeply personal story.
Of course.
It seems amazing to me that you can't tell people that you were clinically dead.
Yeah. Yeah, that's... Yeah.
Seems amazing.
It is. You know, it's amazing to me still, too.
We're going to find out why.
Cool.
So you're divorced now, right?
I am officially divorced now, yes.
How long has it been?
Just over a month since it was final.
Oh, so it's pretty fresh.
Yeah, it got dragged out for a while, though. It got dragged out for almost a year.
Oh, my gosh.
Because COVID.
Oh, right. That doesn't help.
No. It was awful.
It's gumming everything up.
Yeah.
With your divorce just being so fresh... Just 1 month out. How are you feeling about that right now?
I mean, I'm in a better place than I was when my secret happened, but I still struggle with it. I mean, it's, you know, I think anybody who's listening to this and has been married and is divorced or going through a divorce, they know that it's like an emotional roller coaster. It's something you have your good days and your bad days, and you feel like a failure, you know, because, you know, all you can think about is what happened to my marriage. Is it my fault? Is it her fault? It's very confusing and it's very emotional.
Yeah. Can you tell me about your marriage?
Yeah. We met in a city that isn't far from here, actually. It was 12 years ago, I think. 2008, we met, and I moved back to California to be with my parents. My mom had cancer. So my girlfriend at the time actually followed me to California. We kind of did this thing where we looked for a house together. We bought a house. One thing led to another. We ended up getting married about 8 years ago. And then we had our son in 2014. The marriage was great up until a point where we started having some financial issues. And it was just a little difficult to handle those because this is uncharted territory for the two of us. And I think it just caused some really big issues in our relationship, and we stopped communicating and we stopped being intimate. We stopped talking to each other. I guess my divorce was bound to happen eventually, but when it did, I still wasn't prepared for it. It didn't make a difference.
Oh gosh. You were in love though.
Yeah. Yeah, I was. I mean, I made mistakes and I wasn't a good husband for a lot of that. And, you know, I take full responsibility for that. But yeah, I was in love with her. I mean, you know, love changes and evolves. And I think that's part of being married.
I was struck by a comment you made in your original submission to me.
Yeah.
Where you said, I loved her more than I loved myself.
Yeah. I think my thing was that I got really complacent and comfortable and I just kind of let myself go. I lost my job in 2015 and she was the only one working. We had a child, we had a mortgage. The brunt of that was on her. I mean, there was no jobs for me to find. It was really difficult. And so in order to preserve her sanity and her emotional state of well-being, I just stopped caring about myself and focused on not letting her feel that, what I was feeling, because I was pretty depressed. Looking back now, that was obviously the beginning of the end, because I should have communicated that with her. No matter how much I didn't want her to feel that way, it didn't matter. She was already feeling that way. I just didn't want to admit to it. I definitely focused on her emotional well-being while mine just kind of fell apart.
And you were depressed because you had lost the job?
Yeah. It was kind of twofold. I mean, I had been working under a tyrant and he was just one of the worst supervisors I've ever had in my life. And I thought he was going to fire me at any moment. And I had this brilliant plan to go to the hospital and ask for, you know, like a psych evaluation so I could get like a leave of stress or something. And I sat there and told the doctor everything, you know, about how depressed I was and, you know, and how much I just wanted a month off of work so I could look for a new job. And he was just like, I think you need to see a therapist.
You said a few moments ago that you'd made some mistakes in your marriage.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about those?
This is hard to talk about.
We'll be back in a minute, right after this. We're back with Joe, who's about to tell us about mistakes he made in his marriage.
I think in our spiraling away from each other, I'm a male, you know, I even though we weren't close physically, you know, and not even emotionally, I still felt like I needed a sexual release, you know, so I ended up texting back and forth with someone and she caught me. It was awful. I mean, I felt so much guilt for that. And I still do. You know, even though her and I have a pretty decent relationship now, I felt really awful about that. And I was immediately willing to go get help. She decided that she would go and put herself on a dating app profile and go meet some guy. And after that, I was just done. I couldn't come back from that, even though, you know, mine wasn't physical, you know, cheating's cheating. But I don't know. She was just so callous about it. You know, she would do some pretty awful things, you know, even as much as, you know, talking to this guy on the phone while I was only 2 feet from her on the couch and I could hear his voice and she just didn't care. You know, it was like, man, I deserve some of this, but damn, Jesus, you know, it was really cruel. I deserve what I got, but I feel like that was a little overkill.
Did she end up having a physical relationship with the other man?
She did. And, you know, it's hard for me to know when that happened. I mean, I know it happened before we even suggested we should separate. So I felt like, look, you got me, you know, like you got me, you know, I deserve that. Let's go get help, you know? And she just was absolutely relentless in destroying whatever chance we had reconciling our relationship. And it was just, oh man, it was an awful, turbulent time.
Sounds like things got pretty toxic.
Yeah, very, very toxic.
And so at some point you decided that you would get divorced.
Yeah.
Whose decision was that?
It was mine. Even though I backed out a couple times, you know, I think I used it as a bargaining tactic. And then when she was like, okay, I was like, wait. As the months went on, it was just the only option. I think, you know, we both deserved to be happy. And it wasn't going to be with each other anymore. And that still makes me sad, you know, but yeah, it was ultimately my decision to divorce. At the time I had moved out of the apartment that I shared with my wife and my son. And, a couple gracious coworkers of mine, you know, were able to secure a house, here in the city and rent it. And I was able to get out pretty quickly and move in with them. I had to get out of my living situation with my wife. It was just so volatile and toxic. There was nothing abusive. We weren't screaming at each other, but it was just emotionally very, very toxic. And so I actually moved in with these two guys. They were coworkers, and shortly after, I guess I just needed some kind of release, so I signed up for Tinder. That's kind of what led me down to where I'm at today and what happened to me.
Gosh, how could Tinder lead you?
Oh.
I don't know how to say this. Where exactly did Tinder lead you to?
Let's put it this way. I was looking for love in the wrong place. That's for sure.
Is Tinder the wrong place?
I don't know. I don't claim to know exactly what happens after divorce and how you should feel about a new relationship, but I definitely don't think it's the best of apps if you're looking for a relationship. And I really wasn't. I was looking for fun. I just wanted a distraction. But yeah, it led me to a woman who ultimately became kind of the center point of my secret.
You found her profile on Tinder.
I did.
And what was it about her profile that attracted you?
She was hot. I'm not going to lie. I was just kind of swiping right on whoever I thought was cute or whatever. And you know, like I said, I wasn't really looking for a relationship, obviously. I was only a month separate at the time, and I just wanted a distraction. And so I think for me, it was more quantity and not quality. I thought she was so beautiful. And to my surprise, she matched me almost immediately. And we started with a conversation that just went on for hours, quickly turned sexual at some point. That was when we started meeting up.
Well, that connection must have felt pretty good at the time.
Oh, yeah. It was awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was.
At what point did that relationship start to take a bad turn?
She was a drug user. You know, I didn't know it until she told me.
How long into the relationship were you when you found that out?
Actually, it was a couple months. It took a couple months of us just kind of meeting up sporadically. I think there was one night where I gotten off work and she met me in the parking lot and she got into my truck and I was pretty depressed. I was going through some stuff emotionally with my divorce and how my son was dealing with it. And I was trying to explain to her like how I just wasn't feeling like meeting up that night. I just wanted to go home. And she was like, I think I can help you.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Had you used drugs prior to that point?
I had before. Yeah. I mean, I've tried a lot of stuff, but I knew what she was offering me would do the trick because I'd had it before.
What was she offering you?
Oxycodone.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So she said, hey, Joe, I got something for you.
Yeah.
That'll help.
Well, I mean, I had to pay for it. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So she's dealing.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, maybe she was. I have no idea. I'm not trying to defend her. I think that she was kind of a middleman. You know, she had a friend who offered her these pills to sell to me. Yeah, that's what started it. Yeah.
Well, tell me about the first time that she gave you the oxycodone.
The first time she gave it to me, it was from her mom. I guess her mom gets prescribed them for some kind of back injury or something. I mean, I had had a prescription for them. I had been injured years earlier and, you know, my back was in bad shape and still is, but I gotten a prescription for Norco. And, you know, that was such an awful 2 years in my life because, you know, I'd run out of them a week early and then I'd be going through withdrawals. And so eventually, you know, I got off of them. I was able to keep most of this from my family, too. And I think this is what adds to my shame is that they really have no idea.
Okay.
She gave me some 10 milligrams oxycodone. And then, you know, I was kind of buying from her regular from that point on. And it was about a month later, she sold me some pills that didn't look right.
How did they not look right?
I mean, they looked like normal. I knew what they were supposed to look like, but they looked like someone had kept them in their pocket for like a month, you know, like they just looked kind of dirty. And I mean,
a little linty.
Yeah. I mean, that's putting it politely. They look gross. I mean, at this point in my life, they could have come from a balloon in somebody's butt crack and I probably still would have taken it, you know, to be honest. So, you know, it's just anything to make the way I was feeling disappear. You know, that was really all it was.
So you're trying to chase the depression away, but are you also addicted at this point?
I would say so. I don't think I'm in any denial about that. I spying it from her on a regular basis. Yeah, I was addicted. Yeah.
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 And so some alarm bells went off. You did notice that the pills didn't look right.
Yeah.
But you went for it anyway.
Yeah.
And so what happened?
These pills were something I had had before, but they weren't something I got normally. They were 30 milligram oxycodones. And, you know, at my worst, when I was taking them, I mean, 60 milligrams in one shot was not a big deal for me. Like, that was probably borderline, you know, falling asleep, not dying, but falling asleep and or just having a good time or feeling good. That's how much of a tolerance I had built up to it. So these were 30 milligrams a piece, and she had thrown some 5 milligram Percocets in there, which is the exact same drug. It's just a different name, and it's a lower milligram of the opiate. They were in a baggie, and I took one of the 30s, and I didn't feel anything. And I'm like, okay, what's happening? You know, so I took another one thinking like, okay, this is my limit. And I still didn't feel anything. An hour went by, I wasn't feeling anything. And I'm just like, no way, this is not happening, you know? And so I took one of the 5 milligram Percocets, and that was the last thing I remember.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
What happened?
I woke up on the floor of my bedroom, surrounded by like 8 firefighters, completely confused. My chest was hurting really bad. I had leads all over my chest. I had, I was sweaty. I did not know what was happening. And honestly, it didn't take long for me to figure it out. I think once I heard them say like, are you okay? You were out for a little while there. I realized I had overdosed. I mean, I knew. I think that was such an awful feeling to realize what I'd done. And now how am I going to keep that from everybody? You know, because, yeah. You know, obviously my 2 roommates knew what was going on. One of them was a drunk, so he was asleep when it happened. I don't think he really understood the gravity of the situation. But the roommate who found me and initially started CPR, I mean, him and I were pretty close now, and he knows pretty much all of it. So, you know.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
You made it a point to mention that the pills didn't look right. So what did you overdose on? Do you know?
So when I had actually gotten to the hospital, the doctor, and this is so messed up, the doctor brought in a cop, and the cop was like, I need to ask you some questions. And I'm just like, oh man. You know, I was like, how am I going to lie about this? You know? And he was like, before you speak, I already know, you know, what you took because I found them on your bed. And my immediate reaction, and this is going to sound surprising, but I was mad that he took the rest of my pills, you know?
Right.
You know, how awful is that, you know?
Oh.
He had them tested for fentanyl and found out that they were almost pure fentanyl.
Now, fentanyl is a highly addictive drug.
Yeah.
It can cause death.
Yeah, and it did.
It did?
Yeah, it did. You know.
Tell me about that. Have you ever wondered what it's like to die? Stay with me. We're back with Joe's story of 122nd trip to the other side. Do you remember the moment when the doctor told you that you had been dead for over 2 minutes?
Yeah, it was actually the firefighter. He had touched on it, but I didn't understand it at the time. He was more interested in keeping me quiet because my blood pressure was so low. But the doctor came in and, you know, he told me like, you know, you are clinically dead for over 2 minutes. And, you know, he's like, you're lucky your roommate found you. He's like, if you were in there any longer, you would have died. And that really, really, really hit me. I mean, I was one of those people, man, you know, like one of those people who overdosed and I almost died, you know?
So that's the real dose of reality.
Oh, big time. Yeah.
Does that change your perspective on things at all?
You know what, Ben? I don't know. I mean, it didn't at the time, and it didn't take long for it to either. I think in order for me to not make this an issue or have people, the least amount of people know about it as possible, I think I just kind of put it in the back of my mind and I tried not to think about it. And I still do that. And in fact, I still haven't spent a whole lot of time processing it. And I'm only just now doing that 7 months later. And it's very emotional and I feel like I'm like almost shedding my skin a little bit. You know, it's a really weird feeling, but it didn't hit me until 2 days after I had gotten out of the hospital and I took my son to McDonald's. Something happened there that just absolutely changed how I felt about my situation and what had happened to me and for my future and my son's.
Wow. got to let us know.
Yeah.
What happened at McDonald's?
Yeah. So my son, a couple days later, in an effort to make things seem as normal as possible, my son really wanted to go to McDonald's and play in the play area. This is before COVID. And so I just wanted him to have a good night and have fun. So we drove down to McDonald's. We ate. He played for a couple of hours. I remember it started to snow that night really bad. And so I was trying to get him to the truck and get him in there and get him all strapped into his car seat. I don't know if I remember telling him I would be right back. In the past, whenever I would put him in his car seat, take me a few minutes to get into the driver's seat and get the truck started and going. You know, he just kind of sat there and like played on his iPad or something. And so I wasn't thinking much of it. So I put him in his car seat and I heard my name from the parking lot and I turned around and it was someone that I worked with and I hadn't seen her in a while. I kind of just closed the door on my son and walked around and I maybe talked to her for like 2 minutes. You know, it was really cold. When I went back and got in the driver's seat, my son was just like a mess. I mean, he was crying. His face was red. He was like, "Daddy, I thought you left me. I thought you were gone. I thought you weren't coming back." You know,
heart must have been broken.
Yeah. Yeah. That.
My God.
Yeah. That was hard. You know, because he doesn't know how close he came. You know?
How close he came.
To losing me, you know?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it was only a couple of days later. He didn't realize, you know, and hopefully he never will. But yeah, I think that was really hard for me because here he is sitting in the back seat of my truck and he's just thinking that I absolutely like abandoned him and I wasn't coming back. And, you know, he just, little did he know that I came really close to making that a reality for him out of my own stupidity, you know?
No, that's a wake-up call.
Yeah, I think that was where everything really, really changed as far as it just flipped in my head. And I realized that in my attempts to fix my despair and my depression from what was happening, I wasn't focusing on the relationship in my life that mattered most. And that was the relationship with my son. And I took him for granted. It was very reckless of me to do what I did. And you know, he almost lost his father. I almost left him alone in this world, you know.
I can hear the pain in your voice.
Yeah. Yeah, it's still hard to talk about that part. I think it's, but it's like the most important piece to me, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So you were able to console him?
I was. Yeah, I was, and it didn't take long, you know.
Yeah,
he's a 5-year-old. It was easy right? to get his mind off of it, you know. But not my mind. My mind stuck on that for months, and I can imagine it will for years to come. But yeah, I got him calmed down. I got him calmed down pretty easily.
When did you figure out that this was really serious?
You know, I think the second I knew something was really serious was not only when I woke up and saw the police officers and the firefighters, but my chest hurt so bad. And I'd been in the medical field for 15 years before this. I've done plenty of CPR. I've broken plenty of ribs. So I knew almost immediately that I had CPR performed on me. I just didn't know the extent or how bad it was until I had talked to my roommate, you know, later on the next day. But yeah, he had done some very, very aggressive CPR to the point where he cracked my sternum and fractured two of my ribs.
Oh my God, you must have been in so much pain.
Oh my God, you have no idea. You know, you use those muscles for everything, you know, to walk. You know, I mean, you swing your arms when you walk. Those muscles are connected to your pec muscles, which pull on those bones. Oh man, it's just, even thinking about it now, it was painful.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how long ago was this now?
That was 7 months ago. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So can you still feel it?
No, not really. It's pretty much healed over now. And the funny thing is that the way that I hid that from my friends and family, I mean, that was really, really hard to hide that because I had a 5-year-old son at the time, you know, who loves to jump into my arms, you know. But wow. I guess lucky for me, a couple weeks prior to this happening, I had actually gotten up in the middle of the night to get a glass of water and I slipped going down the stairs and I broke two ribs in my back. So I was healing from the ribs broken on my back. And, now I have these new breaks, you know? And so it was kind of easy to hide it because I just kept telling, you know, my son and my ex-wife, my back still hurt. It was super painful and I could feel the bones moving, especially the sternum was really gross. That was, I could feel it rubbing on each other and it was,
oh my God.
Oh, it's gross.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
So Joe, tell me more about the policeman that interrogated you after you had come to.
Yeah, he was super nice in the beginning.
What Joe said when he came back after this. It's time for Joe's final revelation.
For whoever's come down off of an opiate or been revived and resuscitated and had Narcan used on them, I mean, it's very confusing and you're very emotional, especially I think it's from a flooding of your receptors in your brain from the drug, but I was very emotional. And he is sitting there asking me, where did you get these from? We had them tested, they're fentanyl. You know, I guess he had some kind of like fentanyl testing strip or something. I just told him, like, I don't know, man. I don't know where I got them from. I just wanted him to go away. He just was relentless and he just wouldn't stop asking me questions about who I got them from and how many more I had. You know, where are you hiding the rest of them? You know, we found these ones on your bed. Where's the rest of them? Now I understand that because they were cut with fentanyl, he wanted to find out where they were and get them off the street or whoever was dealing them as soon as possible because they're so deadly. But at the time, I mean, I felt like giving up this girl, it wasn't in my best interest and it wouldn't have helped me. I don't think. I think I would have, this would have gone public. I would have had to go and testify, you know, and I just told him, I was like, man, I don't know. I've been collecting them, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, he kind of, you know, he was like, no, that's not good enough. I know you got these from someone. He's like, your roommate told me that you were buying pills from somebody. He's like, and it was a girl you were dating. He's like, what's her name? And I just said, I don't know. I don't want to talk about this. You know, and he was like, well, this is a felony. You can go to jail for this. And he's like, then everyone's going to know about this. And man, I just felt overwhelmed by emotion at that point. Everything bad that I've been using the pills to hold back and keep away just came out. I couldn't keep it back. I mean, I pretty much told him my entire life story, the last like year of my life and what I've gone through. And the entire time I'm just sobbing, you know, and it kind of just put his notebook away. And he was just like, you know what? Let's just count this as a lesson learned. And he's like, you go home and get yourself better. And he's like, don't ever let me find you in possession of this kind of drug ever again. And I was like, yeah, no problem.
Wow.
Yeah.
But then, of course, the underbelly of that mercy that he showed you,
yeah,
is that the fentanyl is still out there if she had any more.
Right. Right.
Were you able to do anything about that?
I did confront her about it. And I did tell her, you know, you sold me some dirty pills, you know. She knew exactly what I was talking about as soon as I told her. And the thing was that, you know, I wasn't as hard on her as I should have been maybe, but she also wasn't the one that was procuring them from, oh God, I can only imagine they come from like the cartel over the border. I mean, that's usually where these, they call them Mexican blues. And that's usually where these come from. They're pressed so perfectly that they look just like, you know, the real thing. I had told her, like, she sold me some bum pills and it almost cost me my life. And she, you know, she said she would talk to her friend, but I doubt that happened. You know, she probably just got high on meth and then, you know, she forgot about it. So, you know.
What was her reaction to what had happened to you as a direct result of the pills that she supplied you?
Yeah, she was really emotional about it. I mean, I could tell it you know, because we had been, you know, in a physical relationship for a few months. But yeah, I could tell she was definitely taken back by it. I could tell it bothered her that I almost died. But beyond that, I mean, I kind of just broke off communication with her at that point. You know, she ended up going to prison. So, you know,
she faced the law some other way.
She did. Yeah. I think it was evading justice or a fugitive from the law. I don't know what happened. She had a warrant for something else and, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So she's in prison. But yeah.
And I imagine you've had plenty of time for introspection.
Yeah. for me, it was just a bad decision that led me down a road that almost cost me everything. But I'm not sad about it anymore. I'm not seeking absolution. I know what I did, and I know it's my fault. That was hard for me to accept at first, because immediately, you know, you want to blame somebody else. You don't want to take the blame for it. But I really spent a lot of time trying to admit to myself, nobody put you here. You did this to yourself. I had actually shared my secret on a website because I needed to get it out. This was about 3 months ago. I got a lot of comments about people asking me, like, you know, like in, people focused on the wrong thing. I felt like they just focused on like, oh, how did it feel to die? You know, what happened when you died? What did you see? I didn't see anything.
You have no recollection of being dead.
No, I don't. Somebody had actually sent me a proverb over direct message on this website. And all it was this proverb, and it was called the woodcutter in the trees. I'd never heard of it. And I know now I think it's Greek, but it's basically about this woodcutter who goes into a forest of oak trees and asks the oak trees, I need a hilt for my axe head. And where can I find a strong material to use for the hilt of my axe? So one of the oak trees directs him to an olive tree and says, those branches are strong, you should use those. And so the man goes and, you know, fashions himself a hilt from this olive tree branch and immediately starts cutting down the oak trees, cutting off their branches and cutting them down to their stumps. And it's super anticlimactic at the end, but the trees are just like, you know, we did this to ourselves. This is our doing. We did this. You know, we allowed him into here, and we told him, you know, what tool to use to make a stronger weapon to cut down trees, and so it's our fault. And so that was all this person sent me, and I'm just like, you know, thinking to myself, like, why? But I think after I read it and I had some time to think about it, like, I'm the oak tree, you know, like, that's me. You know, I allowed this into my life. It's nobody's fault but mine. It's my own choice, you know, and now I feel like I have a choice to be alive. I have a choice to be okay.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
One other question.
Yeah.
You were able to hide this whole experience from the people in your life.
I was.
How did you manage that? How did you explain, you know, being in the hospital and being taken away by the paramedics and all that activity?
Yeah. Nobody really knew I was in the hospital. I was only there for like half a day before they released me. And, you know, that was, so I didn't have to explain that to anybody, thankfully.
Wow.
The hardest part was the pain in my chest from the CPR that was performed. But like I said, I was able to hide that mostly because I had just fallen down the stairs a couple weeks earlier and hurt myself, you know? So, you know, it was kind of just, I was like, oh, still hurts, you know? So. It was difficult. It was really hard. And I wanted to tell people, you know, I didn't want to be alone. I felt very isolated and very lonely. It just really ate at me. And, you know, obviously it still does. Yeah. It's definitely given me a better perspective on how I look at the life of not just myself, but the future of my son as well. And, you know, that's very important.
Well, I wish you a bright future.
Thanks, Ben.
And I wish you a wonderful relationship with your son.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thanks a lot for sharing your story.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
Joe's reckoning, forged in the love for his son, casts him as a father whose worth must be proved, even just for himself. For Joe carries a fable's lesson in his heart. Nothing bothers a man more than to see he is aided in his own undoing. This fervent notion inspired Joe to compose in action, if not in letters, Aesop's unwritten second verse. Inspired by love, the oak tree succumbs not to the woodcutter's plunder, but, in spite, rises tall in full embrace of the sapling it must shade.
Do we have any pictures that we could use for social?
I think I might have a picture of that god-awful room that I guess died in. I was sleeping on an air mattress. I mean, it was pretty sorry.
And we've got pictures.
And I can send you a picture of my son and I.
See Joe and his son and scenes from the story. They're all waiting for you on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and in our Facebook discussion group. Our handle on all social is @SecretRoomPod. And on the next Secret Room Unlocked.
Hear Joe and Ben get deeper in a poignant conversation after the interview was over.
I want to go tell people, like, I died, you know? You know, because nobody gets to come back from that very often, you know? But then I would have to tell them what happened.
Right.
So there goes that vicious cycle of just keeping it in my head and only there.
That's in 1 week on Unlocked. And get excited, people. Coming soon to Unlocked, it's our annual behind-the-scenes show where I interview Ben about all the mayhem we shielded you from that happened to bring you 27 fabulous episodes in 2020.
That's Susie Lark, your host for The Secret Room Unlocked. It's a premium edition of the podcast, and it's available to you when you support exclusively at patreon.com/secretroom. Did you ever find yourself trying to remember that great product we told you about and their great discount code? Check out our cheat sheet. All our sponsors and all their discounts are listed for you at secretroompod.com/codes. Thanks this week to producer Susie Lark, shadow producer Luna Patel, hashtag flipper Alessandro Nigro, the Street Secret team, and Chet, the sound engineer. Our music and theme are by Breakmaster Cylinder. Do you have an ardent secret to share? How could you not? Send it to me now through our website, secretroompod.com. Join me again in just 2 weeks for a front row seat in the Secret Room Stadium. Look under your pillow. You've got VIP tickets waiting for you to the next edition of your favorite indie podcast that could.
You just want me to recite it?
Yeah, anytime.
This is The Secret Room, a podcast about the stories no one ever tells.
Perfect.
I'm Ben Hamm.
Pod on, Joe.
Pod on, Ben.
That's awesome.